Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take another look at the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. Before we get into it, as always, if you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for Deathcast Pod, the Deathcast, or Deathcast Official. You can find me on most social media apps under any one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. Also, share the show on social media. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon, and for as little as $1.99 a month, you can become a Patreon member, get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content. And as always, I do need to shout out my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. Thank you guys, as always, for your support. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week with O.J. Simpson having been acquitted in the double homicide of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. Obviously, there were major ramifications as both families felt that O.J. was guilty of this crime. And despite the best efforts of his lawyers, O.J.'s career as a movie star and actor was basically over from this point on. He became a pariah in society as well as the butt of numerous jokes, which continue until this day. Now, the country was stunned by this verdict that O.J. was not guilty, with, you know, less than half the people thinking that the jury got it right, the other half thinking that the man got away with murder. Obviously, in 2024, mindsets within this country have shifted greatly in that, according to recent polls, an overwhelming majority of people believe that O.J. Simpson committed these murders. While the family is still reeling from all of the fallout from the not guilty conviction, O.J. really takes a low profile, which is not surprising given everything that had happened and how drastically his life had changed due to being accused and despite being acquitted of the crimes. In Los Angeles, it's been reported that African American residents flooded the streets cheering Simpson's acquittal. In October of 1996, the families of the Goldmans and Nicole Brown Simpson filed a civil suit against O.J. Simpson for having caused the murders of their loved ones. The trial officially began on October 23rd, 1996. There was a small jury convened. On November 22nd, 1996, O.J. Simpson is deposed in this civil trial, where he again contended that he had not murdered Nicole or Ron, although he was unable to explain the mountain of evidence that was presented against him. And the families end up winning their civil trial against Simpson on February 5th, 1997, awarding the families $33,500,000 in damages. At the time, Simpson's net worth was estimated to be about $11 million. Basically, with this judgment, O.J. Simpson has nothing left to lose, and he defaults on the Rockingham estate mortgage and basically is not paying any of the damages that he has been ordered to by the court. Now, I have a major, major problem with the civil trial, and it's simply this. Whether O.J. Simpson did this crime or not, he was found legally not responsible by a jury of his peers. And despite courts looking at this as a civil matter, the fact that he was found not guilty, he didn't have a mistrial or a hung jury, he was flat out found not guilty, in my personal opinion, should disbar anyone from being able to seek punitive damages against him after the fact. You know, this is the old saying that justice is blind and innocent until proven guilty. He was found innocent, and in my opinion, that should be the end of it. There should be no ability for family members, whether or not the person actually committed the crime or not, to go after the accused after they have been found not guilty. There was lawyers out there that wanted to take this up. I personally believe that they could at least get a hearing as to whether or not this violates the double jeopardy law, meaning a person cannot be tried twice for the same crime. Yes, this is a civil matter, but in a criminal court, they were found not guilty, and in my opinion, that is morally wrong and reprehensible. So Simpson ends up starting to sell off various possessions of his, the proceeds of which go to the Goldman family. The Goldman family also attempted to go after Simpson's pension of $28,000, but they were unable to gain access to this. And throughout the years, the family has continued to go after Simpson, and now after his estate, claiming they will not stop until the entirety of the judgment is paid to them. Basically, what they're saying is they're going to deny the, at the time, living O.J. Simpson the ability to make any sort of a living. They are also going to deny his estate the opportunity to monetize or otherwise benefit from O.J. Simpson's name, likeness, etc. Simpson tried to do a number of different things, one of which was he tried to register the names O.J. Simpson, O.J. and the Juice as trademarks in order to market himself. Although this was blocked by a concerned citizen who saw this as being morally reprehensible. So Simpson ends up moving to the Miami-Dade County area, where in 2001, he is tried for simple battery on another motorist after a traffic dispute where it's alleged Simpson removed the man's glasses. Simpson was facing 16 years, but he ends up being acquitted on all charges. In December of 2001, the FBI raids O.J. Simpson's home under suspicions that Simpson is involved in a massive money laundering operation as well as ecstasy distribution. And Simpson was dismissed as a defendant in this trial. He had various other minor legal issues over the next few years. Then came the year 2006, where O.J. Simpson inks a book deal to release a book called If I Did It. The Browns end up getting a judgment that they own the copyright to this book and any proceeds from it. And in doing so, they changed the cover of the book to make the word if very small, so seen from a distance, the book reads, I did it. I read this book. It was absolute hot garbage. The scenario that Simpson puts forward for committing the crimes, you know, again, had he actually done it, is both implausible, and Simpson later stated the work of his ghostwriter's mind, meaning it was fiction, that Simpson did not come up with this scenario on his own. I'll read you a passage from this book. Quote, Nicole Jesus, I looked down and saw her on the ground in front of me, curled up in a fetal position at the base of the stairs, not moving. Goldman was only a few feet away, slumped against the bars of the fence. He wasn't moving either. Both he and Nicole were lying in giant pools of blood. I had never seen so much blood in my life. It didn't seem real, and none of it computed. Now, somewhere during all of this, Simpson ends up getting a manager who would later release a documentary which contained exclusive interviews with Simpson, which is where the information about Simpson claiming to have destroyed Kris Jenner with his massive manhood comes from. And in these interviews, OJ comes across as a very unlikable and arrogant individual. On September 13th, 2007, a group of individuals entered a hotel room in Las Vegas and took sports memorabilia, which was later said to be taken at gunpoint. Simpson was among those individuals who entered this hotel room. Simpson ends up being questioned and admits to the police that he was there and that the memorabilia in question was actually stolen from him and he was simply taking it back. Simpson ends up being charged for this crime and ends up being convicted of it, and he ends up getting 33 years in state prison. Simpson ends up being discharged from prison in 2021, and other than social media accounts, he really kept a low profile leading up to his death this year from cancer. But in the intervening years after Simpson's acquittal, a number of theories have been proposed and various individuals have come forward to claim responsibility for the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. And that's really going to be the focus of this episode and possibly another episode covering this case. Now, the first theory we're going to look at is one that was proposed by a Los Angeles general practitioner in a documentary that he put out called Serpents Rising, where he contends that the forensic evidence does not match with what the prosecution put forward at trial and with what the general public perceives to have happened. I'm not deep diving on this particular theory, but we're going to go over the basics of it. This individual, who again is a medical doctor, lays it out that the wounds found on both victims are not consistent with the assault by one individual, but are rather consistent with two individuals wielding two different knives, with one killing Nicole and the other killing Goldman. And he does bring up some very good points, such as the fact that the way Nicole Brown's throat was slit is different from the way Ron Goldman's throat was cut, and that, based on forensics, it appears that their throats were cut from opposite sides. Meaning, if Nicole's throat was cut from left to right, Goldman's was cut from right to left, and that the lacerations in their throats appear to have been caused by two different types of sharp instruments. But he dives a lot deeper than that, going into the fact that the phone records for the night in question between the Brown family and Nicole Brown are not available to the public, and in fact, the prosecution decided not to present these records in court. He contends that the initial time that the phone call between Judy Brown and her daughter was much later than what was presented in open court, somewhere around the 10 o'clock area, or 10:30, something in that general realm. Why is this important? Because the Browns did not live exactly close to downtown Los Angeles. In fact, this doctor points out that it was a roughly 90-minute trip from the Mezzaluna restaurant to the Browns' residence. And on the night in question, this doctor was able to contact the California Transportation Authority and learned that the only route available to the Browns would have taken them through a heavily congested construction zone, which would have further delayed their arrival back at the home. And give you an example, if they left at 8:30 from Mezzaluna Restaurant, it's a 90-minute drive that puts them back at 10. If you put traffic in there, that puts them back at 10:30 or later. However, Judy Brown later stated that she called her daughter somewhere in the range of 9 to 10. As this doctor contends, even if they were able to get through the traffic fairly quickly, which records that he was able to obtain indicate was not possible, the Browns would have been speeding their asses off in order to get home, in order for Judy Brown to place this phone call when she said that she did it. And his contention is simply that because the phone records were not presented at trial, and the phone company will not give these records despite Freedom of Information Act requests, that the actual time of events may have been doctored by the prosecution in order to further prove O.J. Simpson's guilt. Play a small brief section from this film only to illustrate what it is that the doctor who created this film and book is trying to state. This piece is presented simply in an effort to give a complete telling of this case and is not intended to infringe on anyone's intellectual property.
Browns may be a while before they get here because of the traffic up the 405, so we may be here for a bit of a duration.
And we know that the Brown family en route from Dana Point, California, and it could be a while before they get here.
The Brown family lives about an hour and a half to 2 hours from here. The Brown family lives about an hour and a half to 2 hours from here. The Brown family lives about an hour and a half to 2 hours from here.
But what I'd like to do is to take Gloria and Fox News on a challenge at any time of the day or night, and we will travel from Brentwood to Dana Point. If Gloria is able to arrive at the Browns' residence within 67 minutes, I will surrender my medical license. But if Gloria can't do it, I would like for her to surrender her legal license to practice law in the state of California.
So there you can hear basically a major contention that this film raises, and while I'm not going to state outright that O.J. Simpson was not guilty, it does raise some serious questions about what actually occurred on June 12, 1994, but also on the timeline of events. Again, you can find this film on Amazon. You can even find it on YouTube. If you'd like a really, really in-depth explanation of this, friend of the show, Ed Opperman, has done numerous interviews with this doctor and his brother concerning the evidence that they present in this film. It's a fascinating listen, if not at times rambling dissertation from both individuals. Again, it does raise some interesting questions. Knowing that they lived an hour and a half to 2 hours from Brentwood, how did the Browns get home so quickly and place the phone call when they said that they did? Knowing that traffic was at a dead standstill on the night in question, and that they had to travel so far, also the time that they left the restaurant, it's not possible, unless they are, you know, in a DeLorean and traveling through time, or they are breaking laws left and right, speeding home. We are now going to look at the second major theory, and to me, this one is very, very plausible. In the late 90s, early 2000s, a man in prison in California by the name of Glenn Edward Rogers began claiming to friends and family that he had, in fact, murdered Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. Rogers is a convicted serial killer. He was born July 15th of 1962, and he's known to have committed murders in California, Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana. He was suspected of killing individuals as well in Kentucky. He was convicted of 3 murders, with 3 more suspected, although he has claimed to have killed over 70 people. It's known that his timeline of crimes spans from 1993 until the date of his last murder of November 9th, 1995. Rogers grew up in Hamilton, Ohio, and from all indications, he was a pretty sleazy individual, a loner, and a drifter who floated around the country committing various petty crimes before escalating to murder. Now, Ohio authorities believe that Rogers' first victim was an elderly individual whom he strangled to death in Ohio in 1993 before leaving the state and resurfacing in California. Before we get to what he has said about Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, we're going to discuss the other crimes of which he was either convicted or is suspected. An individual by the name of Mark Peters was discovered in a cabin owned by the Rogers family in Beattyville, Kentucky. Peters was known to Rogers in that Peters had allowed Rogers to move into his home in Hamilton, Ohio, prior to 1993. Peters was an elderly gentleman of 71 years old at the time that his body was discovered. So he ends up going missing, and the police trying to locate him. Eventually, Roger's brother, Clay, comes into contact with the police and leads them to the family's cabin where Mark Peters' body is found bound to a chair and hidden underneath a pile of furniture. On September 28, 1995, a 33-year-old mother of 3 by the name of Sandra Gallagher was seen in the presence of Rogers at a bar in Van Nuys, California. This is in the Los Angeles area. On September 29th, Gallagher's corpse was found in her truck parked near the apartment that Rogers was living in Van Nuys. Gallagher's body had been set on fire and it was later determined that she had died from strangulation. On October 30th of 1995, a 34-year-old mother of two named Linda Price went missing from Jackson, Mississippi. It is known that Rogers and Price had met at the Mississippi State Fair in the fall of 1995, and this too quickly began a relationship, eventually sharing an apartment in Jackson, Mississippi. According to Price's sister, Linda, the last time she had seen her sister was on October 30th of 1995. And they had made plans to spend time together the next day. However, Linda did not answer the door the following day on Halloween when her sister went to pick her up. After police were contacted, Linda Price was found strangled to death inside of her bathtub. On November 5th, 1995, Tina Marie Cribbs was seen leaving a bar in Gibsonton, Florida, with a man later identified as Rogers. According to the bartender at this bar, Rogers had been buying drinks for Tina and her friends on that night and had later asked Tina to give him a ride home. A few days after this, cleaning staff at a Tampa 8 Inn, while cleaning a room previously occupied by Rogers, discovered the decomposing body of Tina Marie Cribbs in the bathtub. She had been stabbed in the chest and the buttocks. And it was later learned that the occupant of the room had arrived at the hotel a few days prior, that on November 5th he had paid for an extra night and instructed the hotel not to clean the room. An employee at the hotel later said that they saw Rogers loading his belongings into a white Ford Fiesta. The following day, November 6th, Cribbs' wallet was discovered at a rest area. They quickly linked the fingerprints found on this wallet, as well as those in the hotel, to Glenn Rogers. Now, after leaving Florida, Rogers, driving Gibbs' car, headed through Louisiana and up into Kentucky, where police, who had been given an APB concerning Gibbs' car, quickly flagged the vehicle and gave chase. On November 13th, 1995, they were able to apprehend him after setting up a roadblock in Waco, Kentucky. Questioned about the vehicle, Rogers stated that Gibbs had loaned it to him and that when he had left Florida, she had still been alive. Rogers ends up going to trial for Gibbs's murder, and on July 11th, 1997, he is sentenced to death. Rogers ends up getting extradited to California, where he is tried for murders there and also is convicted. Now, how do we get the correlation between Glenn Rogers and Nicole Brown Simpson? There's a few different versions of this story out there. I first heard this story in the early to mid-2000s that a house painter who had been working for Nicole Brown Simpson while in police custody had admitted to having murdered Nicole Brown Simpson, and that this was after she refused his advances, and it was therefore a sex crime. However, Rogers has changed his story over the years. At first, the story that he gave was that he had gone into Nicole Brown Simpson's home in order to burglarize it, and that Nicole had come home while he was in the midst of this robbery and had murdered her, with Goldman later appearing on the scene. Now, on the face of it, there are some problems with this particular scenario in that we know Nicole came home with her children, that her children were in bed at the time of the murders, that they'd had a friend with them when they came home, that this friend's father had come and picked his daughter up. If we take this further to the next claim that Rogers said, which is that he was not actually surprised by Nicole, but that he had been surprised by her when he approached the house to break into it, that particular avenue makes a little more sense in terms of that would allow the children to be put to bed, the friend to be picked up, etc., etc. Then his family begins to speak to law enforcement and to the media, stating that Rogers had claimed and told them that he had, in fact, been hired by O.J. Simpson to break into Nicole Brown Simpson's home to steal back various pieces of jewelry and other valuables that he had given her throughout the years, and that Simpson had stated to him that he might have to kill the bitch. And that's a direct quote from Glenn Rogers. Rogers also stated that Simpson had paid him to do this robbery. His brother Clay has come out and stated that Rogers knew Simpson as he was a local house painter, and he was familiar with her as he had worked inside of her home. Clay later stated that his brother informed him after being arrested and convicted that he had planned on taking down Nicole Brown Simpson. Again, that's a direct quote from Rogers' brother Clay, and that Clay did nothing with this information, simply believing it to be hyperbole from his brother. Rogers ended up having a lengthy interview with a criminal profiler during which Rogers laid out a very detailed recounting of how the murders had gone down, going so far as to draw pictures of where the bodies were found, the conditions they were found in, well before pictures of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman's bodies had leaked to the public, but also drawing a knife that matches what the prosecution contends had been used to commit these murders. Obviously, the Brown and Goldman families, as well as the Los Angeles Police Department, have refuted the evidence that Rogers has given to these individuals, most notably in a documentary called My Brother the Serial Killer. Rogers has continued to claim that he was in fact responsible and that O.J. Simpson had hired him to commit these crimes. My major bone of contention with this is that there are no records to indicate whether or not any amount of money that Simpson had was missing. Rogers has stated that the $8,000 that Simpson claimed had been stolen from his house by the police, which he later discovered, was in fact the money that was paid to Rogers for the committal of these crimes. But again, we do not have a detailed accounting of O.J. Simpson's financial records from this period of time in order to be able to say with absolute certainty that Simpson did in fact give this mother money to Rogers to commit the crimes. Nor do we have any evidence that suggests that earrings were removed from Nicole Brown Simpson's house either before or after the murders, nor any other items of value. And here is why I say it is possible that this one happened. The doctor who asserted that the forensic evidence did not match the idea that a lone killer was responsible leaves open the idea of who may have been responsible for these murders. If we take that information, and mind you, you have to take all of this with a grain of salt, and the confessions of Glenn Rogers, it is possible that two individuals were there on the night that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were murdered. If we take a further leap, it's not outside of the realm of possibility that Rogers, who is known to have known Nicole Brown Simpson, may have been one of those individuals, and that O.J. Simpson may have been the other individual involved. He may have hired Rogers to come with him to commit these acts, as Simpson may have felt that he might not have been able to commit them himself, and therefore he wanted backup in case something went sideways. That would explain Simpson's cut hand, as well as his blood being found at the crime scene, as well as the idea that the victims were killed with two different knives and that were stabbed in the throat from different sides of the body, meaning that the individuals wielding each knife held the knives with the opposite hand of the other perpetrator. That's not to say that this is in fact what happened, only conjecture and within the realm of possibility. If we take into account the fact that O.J. Simpson has continued to deny his involvement in the murders, and juxtapose all of this information, we can come up with a theory that O.J. may not have physically committed the crimes, but he may have paid for them and in fact gone with Rogers to watch as he committed the crimes. Things went awry, O.J. became involved, and that is how he ended up becoming injured before fleeing the scene. Again, that is just a theory. My personal opinion on the case is this, and as always, I save this for the very end. I thought I might get two episodes out of this, but it's just not going to happen, which is fine because I have the next case already lined up and researched to go. I believe that O.J. Simpson most certainly did kill his wife, and that Ron Goldman was simply collateral damage. As to the how of it, I have two different thought processes on it. I think that after being snubbed at the recital by the Brown family, O.J. was really pissed off, and that he left, went home, met up with Kato Kaelin, and was trying to forget about it. But given the fact that he was unable to move on from his ex-wife and that she was doing her best to move on with her life following their tumultuous relationship and failed reconciliations, he was unable to do so. I think that O.J., after leaving Kato, decided that he was going to go over to Nicole's house and either scream at and threaten her, or possibly beat the living shit out of her over this perceived snub. Now, here's where I have two different theories. In OJ's book, If I Did It, he states that Nicole answered the door with a knife in her hand, and that they began arguing, that he was able to get control of that knife and later use that knife to kill Nicole and Ron Goldman, who happened upon the scene during the course of Nicole's murder. That one is a possibility. I don't believe it's what actually happened. I think it's more likely than not that O.J. never went to Nicole's door with the idea of, you know, knocking and then confronting her. I think O.J. stole the keys from Nicole's home, went to the house, entered through the side gate, and had every intention of going into the house and surprising Nicole Brown Simpson, either with the intent of murdering her or of catching her in the act of doing something that he found to be, you know, quote-unquote, morally reprehensible and beating the shit out of her and the other individual, or of just going into the house and beating her. I believe OJ went through the front door. Nicole, knowing that Ron Goldman was on his way over, went outside and encountered OJ on the walkway. And it was at this point that OJ, already feeling slighted and enraged, lashed out and killed his ex-wife. And during the course of murdering his ex-wife, Ron Goldman came up, entered the yard, and either found OJ in the midst of killing his ex-wife or having just committed the crimes. There's also the possibility that Goldman came up, saw the bodies, OJ was still on the scene, was unseen by Goldman, and at this point, Simpson decided to attack him in an effort not to leave any witnesses. And at this point, OJ ends up cutting his hand on the knife as he assaults Goldman, and Goldman attempts to fight back. After which, OJ, in a panic, flees the scene, dropping the glove and the knit cap. Using his bloodied hand, exits through the side gate, gets into his Bronco, and rushes back to Rockingham, knowing that whatever it was that he had planned had gone horribly awry, and he needed to get himself away from the crime scene as quickly as possible. He scales the wall because he sees the limo sitting there and does not want anyone to be able to link him to not having been there during the time that the murders were committed. He is seen by Cato Kalin running across the front yard and quickly rushes into the house, where he begins to clean himself up as well as any evidence that he can in the short period of time that he has left before he gets in the limo to leave. He takes the bloody clothing, as well as any bandages he may have used, along with the murder weapon, puts them in this half-moon-shaped travel bag, and then contacts the limousine driver, letting him know what's going on, and that, you know, he had overslept and he was sorry, he's rushing around. At which point, Simpson leaves the property with the limousine driver, and while he's at the airport, he disposes of all of the critical evidence against him in this dumpster. Now, in the weeks after Nicole Brown Simpson was murdered, while it would have been an arduous task, the LAPD could theoretically still have found out where trash from LAX was taken, and attempted to go through the landfill in order to try and locate this bag. Although that would have been, you know, the equivalent of locating a needle inside of a haystack, and more likely than not, would not have resulted in the recovery of this evidence. The third theory as to what happened that I'm going to present is this. It's just as plausible as the idea that Simpson went to Nicole's house and surprised her outside. Simpson may have gone over there on the evening of June 12, 1995, with the idea of either murdering or seriously injuring his ex-wife. Unbeknownst to him, Ron Goldman has arrived on the property, and Simpson, seeing the two of them together out there discussing whatever it was they were discussing, jumps to the conclusion that this is his wife's new boyfriend. Already enraged, Simpson then strikes Goldman from behind, knocking him to the ground and unconscious, before turning his attention to Nicole Brown Simpson, who he knocks to the ground before slashing her throat brutally and leaving her to bleed out. Simpson then turns around and turns his attention to Ron Goldman, who by this point is either regained consciousness or is at least showing signs of life. At this point, Simpson breaks into a flurry of activity, stabbing Goldman viciously in an attempt to get his hands on Goldman so that he can slash his throat. Goldman fights back fairly vigorously, which leads to Simpson slashing first one side of his throat and then the other side. Then Simpson punctures various parts of Goldman's body before leaving the dying man there and fleeing the crime scene and going through the actions that I'd already described. Once in Chicago, Simpson, believing that he has gotten away with all of this, plans on going about things in his normal fashion. However, he did not take into account the fact that the wife's dog has alerted to the neighbors, and therefore, when the LAPD, through Arnell Simpson, contacts him, he is taken by surprise. He is unable to hide the fact that he's not surprised over the fact that his wife has died, and therefore comes off as cold and callous in his exclamations of, "What about my kids?" Not asking any questions about how Nicole died, what happened, etc., etc., because he has not had enough time to prepare himself for this moment, believing that it would be some hours before Nicole's body was discovered, at which point he would more likely than not have been on the golf course with television cameras aimed at him, at which point he could, learning this information, he could turn on the showman part of himself and try and fool everyone. As for the trial, I don't believe that Christopher Darden and Marcia Clark presented a strong enough case to convince the jury that O.J. Simpson was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in the murder of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. Part of this is the fact that they decided to rely entirely on DNA evidence to try and get a conviction on Simpson, when the mountain of physical evidence against him, even if we discount the DNA evidence, could have been enough to have him convicted. They also did not call numerous key witnesses who had, you know, perjured themselves during the pretrial hearing by stating that they had not given any interviews, etc., etc., when in fact they had given interviews and been paid for these interviews. But they also allowed the defense team to get away with everything. They allowed the defense to present this cockamamie hypothetical idea that Simpson was innocent and that the LAPD had in fact planted evidence in order to make it appear that Simpson was guilty of these crimes. They did not go to bat for the two officers who were most responsible for this case, that being Van Adder and Lange, and help to rehabilitate their reputations in the eyes of the jury. And this greatly damaged the prosecution's case, because it allowed the defense team to basically sling mud willy-nilly without any response or objections from the prosecution. But that's not the only thing that hampered the prosecution's case. The prosecution, specifically Darden and Clark, became too wrapped up in their own celebrity during this trial to offer any sort of effective case, because they were too worried about how they were going to appear to the American public. In their mind, they had an open and shut case, despite the fact that they didn't use the evidence that they had in order to ensure a conviction. This was further compounded by the fact that Mark Furman lied under oath numerous times concerning his use of racial slurs, and that once the defense was able to get a hold of this and present it in open court, it basically nullified anything that the prosecution had put forward up until that point, because one of their major witnesses was now a confirmed racist, and if he's a racist, then everyone else involved in the investigation is going to be painted with that brush, and all of their actions are going to be looked at by the jurors as being tainted and untrustworthy. So that is my view on all of this concerning O.J. Simpson. Again, he died from prostate cancer this year. Some commentators have stated that, you know, we may never know the truth. Everyone who has seriously looked into this case knows the truth and knows that Simpson was and is, in fact, guilty of these crimes, but it sells magazines, books, and puts eyeballs on television shows if you throw in that hint of questionable reality when it concerns this case. This case was open and shut from the beginning based upon the evidence that they had, but the prosecution blew it. And again, they allowed the defense team to run roughshod over them without any sort of real return salvo to try and resurrect their case. OJ was found not guilty, and in my personal opinion, based on everything that took place at trial, that was the only reasonable conclusion that the jury could have come to based on the cases that both sides presented. We are at the end of this week's episode. I sincerely hope that you have enjoyed my coverage of the O.J. Simpson case, and I look forward to hearing your thoughts on it. You can drop me an email at ian@corpsecreeppublishing.com or on any one of the social media sites. If you are a Patreon member, of course you have 24/7 access to me to give me your thoughts on various aspects of this case or even what you think really happened. Until next time, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasting. Stay morbid.